there's sometimes there people look at kind of growth work and they say, oh gosh, those guys are just focused on button color, et cetera. And the reality is that consumers really react to relatively small differences in things like word choice, you know, in things like, you know, button placement. They very much react to how much you really simplified, you know, a particular experience.
This is Equivalent to Magic, a show about the tech wizards behind the most influential companies and platforms. I'm Quentin Clark.
And I'm Steve Herrod. Together we go deep with tech execs, product developers, and engineers about how they dream, design, and build their way to scale. This week, David Hahn, a product expert who's been an executive at LinkedIn, Instacart, and GoFundMe. He was a VP of product at LinkedIn for over 9 years, and most recently he served as chief product officer at Instacart.
One thing that we know about being on the product side, it involves a lot of trial and error. And so we'll start with a story of failure, something David tried to implement at LinkedIn that just didn't work. He was in charge of the subscriptions business at the time, and he was trying to figure out how to give normal, individual users a powerful enough experience that would get them to pay for the service.
You know, probably in some cases mistakenly, I more than anybody else got a lot of conviction around a set of features that we called Profile Organizer. And the idea was that we were going to build sort of this very lightweight CRM on top of LinkedIn for the everyday user. So this wasn't targeted at salespeople. It wasn't targeted at recruiters. We had much sort of deeper functionality for those kind of profile cohorts. But this was just going to be for kind of everyday professional.
David admits on this particular project, he focused on the wrong things for the wrong set of users.
I made the mistake of thinking that, you know, sort of my problems were everyone's problems. And so I just had a tremendous amount of confidence that that this particular feature set was just going to, you know, blow the doors off of our subscriptions business. And you know, that was not the case. You know, I checked multiple times to make sure that we were tracking things correctly, because I was sure that the crickets we were hearing must have been a tracking problem and not, you know, my product manager problem of sort of having made the wrong bet here. But it turned out that, you know, it was not a feature that was, you know, broadly interesting to people. And it wasn't quite crickets, but it was pretty darn close.
So David recognized that it just wasn't working. And so like any good team leader, he dug in with his team to find out why.
You know, once you kind of pass the period of, you know, kind of hoping that the metrics change and then realizing that they're not. So again, we sort of went back to the understand, you know, phase of the project, did a lot more of our homework there, and just recognized that we'd already served a lot of the customers that had this pain point. And, you know, for everybody else, this was just, you know, very much a nice to have and really not something they spent a whole lot of time thinking about and therefore didn't really resonate.
Throughout his career, David has learned deep and meaningful lessons about what individual and enterprise customers need and how to translate those needs into fun, usable products. His resume includes a wide range of successful tech startups, so we started by asking him what ties the experiences at LinkedIn, GoFundMe, and Instacart together.
First and foremost, they're all consumer companies. So with the exception of a small part of the portfolio over at LinkedIn, which I'd characterize as a little bit more kind of prosumer, edging towards, you know, enterprise, they're all consumer experiences where we're building product for a large scale, you know, consumer audience. And so kind of along with those experiences, going from company to company, you start to realize there's really a lot of similarity in things like consumer behavior. There's a lot of similarity in sort of the techniques that we use to acquire users and to get them to re-engage. And then even from sort of a testing perspective, the way that you sort of put together A-B tests and roll out and launch features, again, you sort of see a lot of similarity. So I've been able to carry some of those lessons from company to company. I think the second common thread is they're all very utilitarian. So if you think about it, they're consumer, but they're trying to get a very specific job done. You're trying to shop for groceries. You're trying to hire someone. You're trying to raise money. And I'm just sort of naturally drawn to those sorts of products and product problems. I'm not the right guy for, you know, sort of a, you know, gaming company or sort of entertainment. I really like these sort of practical consumer problems, and that's been a common thread across all three companies.
Is you spent 7 years at LinkedIn, and that scaled from what, 40 employees or something to 7,000? How did the nature of how you were engaging that consumer play change?
Yeah, so it was actually a little bit over 9 years, if you can believe it, which is an eternity in Silicon Valley. And you're right, it was a very small scale when I joined and thousands of employees when I left. you know, those first chapters, they're really all about trying to kind of find that product market fit. You know, when I joined, you know, we were still just getting people to join the network, let alone get them to engage and build, you know, sort of lots of applications or monetization streams on top of it. So those early days, we're trying to figure out really how to sort of tune that core value proposition. And at some point, you start to see evidence that you've got it and you've got it right. And then sort of the scale chapters come in, really building up the applications that you build on top of the platform and finding ways to sort of add a lot more value to users across a bunch of different sort of profile segments. And so you go from kind of early days, entrepreneurial, you know, trying to really crack the nut of product market fit. And then all of a sudden you're playing this scale game where you're really building the team and you're really building out sort of capabilities across a bunch of different functions.
Well, this is great. I mean, you've done so many cool projects in your career. Maybe we can just dive pretty low now and talk about a specific tool or project. Maybe you could talk about a couple that you found just particularly elegant or something that's really stuck with you, a specific project or tool over the years.
Yeah. So I think, you know, probably one of the most recent examples is at Instacart, and it was around improving what we called fulfillment quality. And what that term means, you know, I think most people, they probably don't realize what a complex problem that Instacart has really just done a great job of solving. You know, Instacart is delivering from grocery stores. Grocery stores on average have 30,000 unique SKUs. So 30,000 items, you know, in those stores. And grocery stores have a very poor understanding of what their own inventory actually looks like. So I think a lot of us in Silicon Valley just sort of assume, oh, sure, I can just go grab a file and it has the precise kind of real-time inventory at any point. That's not the case. That's not even close to the case. And so a lot of the really elegant work that Instacart has done, and this has been going on really since the inception of the company, but in the last couple of years specifically, there's some really elegant things that we've done, not only to understand the inventory, you know, from our own systems in a particular store, and putting a lot of sort of complex, you know, tech against that problem, but also to do a really elegant job handling when we get that forecast wrong, you know, handling when we are wrong about whether a specific item is in stock, and the way that we sort of in a very simple way are able to interact with the user before they've even checked out to sort of nudge them along to make sure that we're getting some backup preferences so that we're making them, you know, sort of as happy as possible. And again, it may sound trivial, but, you know, for anyone that's been on the other end, you know, when you miss a specific item at the store, it's a really big deal, or it could be a really big deal because all of a sudden it might be the key item that you're making for dinner. And so it's a really hard problem, not just because of the limited information we get from stores and all the unique items, but the tolerance from a consumer perspective for any error. You know, you might say, oh gosh, if you get one item wrong out of 20, gosh, seems like you've done a pretty good job. Well, if that was the item that, you know, is sort of the mainstay for the meal this evening, you're pretty frustrated as a consumer. And so a lot of the work that, you know, Instacart has done there, and especially in the last couple of years, has been especially elegant because it's tied together solutions across multiple parts of the product. So it's everything from systems that are trying to forecast the inventory. It's pulling in, you know, data from the app the shopper is using. It's, you know, affecting the consumer experience. How do we think about search relevance? How do we recommend specific items that are similar? And so of all the projects I've worked on, it's the one where I sort of look at and I can almost look at every team in the ecosystem at Instacart and say they played a role in this one elegant solution from a consumer perspective, which is make sure that when I'm ordering the 20 items, we're doing the best possible job to make sure that I'm happy with the items that ultimately end up at my doorstep.
It must be a really complex problem, right? Because it's not just a matter of an incredibly intensive real-time data challenge, which has never been solved before. Even knowing what's happened at point of sale doesn't tell you because there's things on people's carts still floating around the store, right? Even if you could get the rest of inventory perfect. And then you have a set of human issues too. It's possible that your shoppers aren't familiar with certain things, right? So how'd you go about like building the empathy with the team to really understand that pain point deeply?
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, the first part of that is, as with all products, is to really, truly understand the problem. And I think that, you know, over time, you know, these teams did an especially good job at this part of the product process. And that was, you know, really everything from kind of deeply embedding, you know, with Instacart shoppers. And this is like deeply embedding over a long period of time, kind of following shoppers around to make sure we really understood some of those decisions, you know, in fact, you know, Quentin, that you were just alluding to, some of those kind of micro decisions decisions that they're making in the store. You know, I think the, you know, Instacart is very much a customer feedback culture. And so there's a lot of different channels that were sort of already built into, you know, kind of just the way the Instacart teams work in terms of getting customer feedback. But we're also users of all the products, you know, on both sides. Mm-hmm. We, you know, we're all consumers, you know, using the Instacart service, and everyone in the company, and this is actually one of the most interesting sort of empathy building exercises, you know, everyone in the company goes on a periodic sort of shop as a shopper. And so it's not just within the product teams, but it's really broadly across the company that there's empathy for what the shoppers are, you know, what their workflow looks like and sort of how that application kind of ties to the job that they're trying to get done. And so I think that understand phase was critically important. And then just again, sort of leveraging all the channels that we could get. And that's, you know, leveraging things like, you know, verbatims from NPS, you know, monitoring, you know, social channels. And then of course, just really deeply, you know, diving into data and understanding, you know, where do some of these misses happen? And then how do we resolve them? So really a multi-channel approach to, you know, everything from, you know, kind of very mathematical to the very qualitative to get those insights.
I love that at your companies, especially this one that you've been at, the employees can have direct empathy and really understand the problem. I know, especially these days, like I'll take any paper towel you can possibly give me, but I got to have the exact right brand of coffee or I'm going to be really grouchy or something like that. So, and do you kind of roll out these products internally first, or do you do just typical A/B testing?
Yeah, so I think for most consumer products, you know, we go through a process of different companies use different terms. You know, I think most companies use the term dog fooding. Yet some companies, we try to use a little bit more of a euphemism of kind of drinking your own champagne. But in any case, it's certainly making sure that you're trying, you know, the product first, and then, you know, of course, rolling out in sort of a more traditional kind of A/B approach. You know, the really interesting thing about, you know, again, the Instacart ecosystem is some of the changes that you're making on the fulfillment side, they affect, you know, a whole cohort of shoppers. You know, they affect a whole, you know, cohort, you know, of your supply chain. And so really the team has learned to master, you know, sort of a much more complex approach to A/B testing, certainly than just a, you know, kind of a standard, you know, consumer facing company would have to engage on. So that really went through sort of years of iteration. I think, you know, especially in the last 2 years, Instacart really, you know, invested in sort of its experimental framework so that we could capture things that were happening, you know, changes that were happening on the fulfillment side, how they flowed through all the way to the customer experience, and really proud of, you know, the data team, especially, that did a lot of that work for us.
That's cool. No, I think I've ordered both dog food and champagne on Instacart, so I've got it all covered. This is really cool. And any, I know, just sort of stepping back a little bit from this or some of the other times you've done this, any lessons on the project that you think people listening to this could really take to heart, like something that went awry that you really would do differently in the future?
Yeah, I mean, I think in this case, you know, for the most part, because at the outset, we spent a lot of time, you know, talking about, you know, why we were going to go solve this problem. And frankly, although we spent a lot of time explaining why, you know, the employees, you know, they get it, right? They understand the core problem because, you know, they're both, as I said before, both consumers of the service and built up a lot of empathy on the shopper side. And so, again, I think all that pre-work that happens makes things like, you know, this cross-company sort of initiative so much easier, and it makes it go so much more smoothly. You know, I think the one thing that I really took away from this project, I think, as you think about fulfillment quality, there's a whole portfolio of things that you can do. And that portfolio ranges from relatively small tweaks, you know, to pretty significant, you know, changes to the fulfillment stack. And some of the kind of the product, you know, work that I was just referring to, one big piece of that actually was much more on the spectrum of longer term, you know, play that really took about 6 months before we started to get any signal whatsoever in terms of, you know, whether or not it was going to work. And so it turns out a lot of these changes did have a significant impact. And so I think the reminder for me is that, you know, sometimes it's sort of easier to do kind of some of the short term, you know, quick hits. And it's comforting because you get to see the results very quickly and you get to correct very quickly. And you know, let's be honest, you're really not taking that much of a risk. You know, for this particular project, these are, as I mentioned, pretty significant changes against a broad set of the ecosystem. And then, you know, having to kind of wait 6 months to really understand even sort of the first glimmer of, are we on to something or not? And so, you know, that can be, you know, for me and, you know, the rest of the team, pretty nerve-wracking. It's like, look, we have a lot of conviction we're right, but, you know, it's a bet because we're not sure that we're right. So I think the big takeaway for me, and it's easy because this project, you know, worked out, you know, well, is just a reminder that, you know, you got to make sure that you have a portfolio approach to the bets you're taking, and not just to keep, you know, staying so focused on the safety blanket of some of the smaller changes, and take the bigger swings, because the bigger swings, you know, they can really pay off. And in this case, you know, they did.
Yeah. I mean, it's a great example of often you hear the founder story of, you know, what made you decide to build this? What guided you? And like, well, I just want to build something that I would use, right? And what you don't hear is the 100 right. other startups that failed because they took exactly that same approach, right? And the advantage that's you right. have at a large company is you have a user base you can tap into slowly and draw from and learn from and build cohorts around, et cetera. And so it really was that user engagement that gave you that signal of not launching this thing.
That's right. That's right.
So shifting gears a little bit, I mean, one of the things that I think the places you've worked for are, you know, somewhat famous for is doing a really good job with growth and the sort of the growth discipline and that capability of taking the user base and figuring out how to continue to expand it, taking that top of funnel and continue to refine how effective it is. You know, tell us a little bit about growth and why you think it's an important competency for companies to lean into earlier on, as opposed to, you know, just engineering or just marketing or whatever.
Yeah. So we started, it's funny, when we were first doing, you know, kind of growth work at LinkedIn, you know, it was 2005 actually. And so, I don't even think we were referring to growth work as kind of growth work at that time. We spent a lot of time in those early days, recognizing that, and it, you know, it takes you a while after you kind of launch a couple of experiments, but you know, you start to see how much you learn, you know, from each of those things that you're able to sort of put live in front of a customer. And so what you recognize early on is that a lot of it is a velocity game. You know, how quickly, mm-hmm. You know, can you get a lot of these experiments live? And the other thing that you start to appreciate is that these small changes do actually make a really big difference. You know, I think there's sometimes there people look at kind of growth work and they say, oh gosh, those guys are just, you know, focused on button color, et cetera. And the reality is that consumers really react to relatively small differences in things like word choice, you know, in things like, you know, button placement. They very much react to how much you really simplified, you know, a particular experience. And so a lot of growth work is actually just pulling stuff off of a particular page. So those are all things that, you know, I think we learned in some of the early days at LinkedIn. But as we'd start to learn lesson one, lesson two, lesson three, we realize, oh gosh, we can actually just go speed this up. And we can speed it up by building an engine, by building a team inside the organization, by building sort of a you know, a process and a philosophy where we can get a lot of these experiments out live to relatively small segments of the audience and just learn much faster than we normally could. And I think the other thing that's important with growth work is, you know, some of it is kind of value proposition testing, but again, you know, other parts of it are just really tuning to these kind of consumer behaviors of kind of word choice and of, you know, simplicity and flow. In many cases, yes, you do some understand work to try to figure out and to have some sort of framework and kind of thematic approach to the kinds of tests that you're going to be running. But, you know, part of, you know, growth work is perfect is enemy of the good. The whole process is to be moving fast and getting stuff out there and having a lot of your experiments fail. And so it is a pretty different approach. You know, the product people, the team that's, you know, kind of deployed against, you know, a particular product group kind of, you know, with a focus on growth, it does require sort of a shift in mindset, you know, relative, you know, to folks that are, for example, you know, building some core service in search or building some, you know, sort of core part of your enterprise product. It's not that product managers from those areas can't be successful in growth, but they have to sort of very proactively kind of change their mindset for how they're going to approach the product problem in the process.
Yeah. Anything you can recall that was particularly surprising in any of the growth work you've done? Just a funny anecdote of had no anticipation of an effect being as powerful as it was.
Yeah, I think one of the, you know, probably one of the first experiments that really paid off for us at LinkedIn, you know, back in 2004 or 2005, LinkedIn actually had built an Outlook toolbar. And the Outlook toolbar was that this toolbar LinkedIn would have you download so that you could upload your contacts from Outlook. And part of our, you know, thesis at the time was that Well, LinkedIn is for professionals, and their professional contacts are in Outlook, you know, and so, which all makes sense. The problem is the number of steps to go download, you know, the Outlook toolbar and, you know, export the PST file and, you know, upload it and import your contacts. You know, no consumer in their right mind is going to do it. And so we are one of the first people, which sounds crazy in this day and age, but we are one of the first companies to really focus on importing from webmail. And this is at a time before all the webmail providers had APIs. And we built some pretty interesting tech in order to be able to import contacts from webmail. And again, before we launched it, we sort of looked at it and said, gosh, well, but those are people's personal contacts. That's not going to work. That's not going to resonate. And of course it did. And it resonated mostly because it was a two-click process in order to upload your contacts. And so even if the contacts were less relevant, you know, it didn't matter. And what we found is, in fact, there was a lot of overlap between the people that might be in your personal email address or your personal email, you know, service and Outlook. But again, the most important thing, of course, was you could do one and two steps and the other, took 10 steps. And that was, of course, all the difference. And so, so that was actually probably one of the first inflection points for us as a company in terms of the overall growth rate, and something that in retrospect seems obvious, but at the time, didn't necessarily fit with our worldview on sort of, you know, professional versus personal.
One other kind of interesting thing across your career has been most of the companies have two strong constituents for the products. At Instacart, it's the shoppers and the buyers. It's at GoFundMe, it's the people raising money and the people donating, and maybe a little less so LinkedIn, you have maybe it's the individuals and companies that are looking to recruit them or other cases. But maybe you can reflect on the particular types of problems that these two-sided models tend to create, whether on the tech front or monetization or growth. But it is unique for your career.
I think monetization specifically is an area that, you know, think about some of these companies. What you learn about consumers is that, and rightfully so, consumers are very demanding. They want high-quality products at low prices. And so I've seen that, you know, time and time again. You know, at GoFundMe, for the most part, the vast majority in GoFundMe's business model for a long time was actually taking a percentage of dollars raised. It's actually, you know, switched to an entirely tips-based model, which is really interesting. But at the time when it was kind of percentage of dollars raised, you know, most people were accepted that as kind of the business model, frankly, because they were surprised that they were raising, you know, any money at all. And so it sort of felt so net beneficial to them that it was okay. You know, the challenge we'd run into those, in some cases, the campaigns would get really big, and they'd raise, you know, the campaigns because of GoFundMe, largely because of GoFundMe, and you know, some cases because of other, you know, kind of factors, they'd raise a lot of money, you know, and in those cases, you know, the percentage, the small percentage, all of a sudden becomes a pretty, you know, big dollar amount. And that's part of what, you know, got us to start thinking, you know, more about, you know, a tips-based approach, you know, et cetera. But consumers are demanding. They, of course, want something at a lower price. I think in Instacart's case, you know, I think the vast majority of users, you know, understand that, you know, there's a fee, you know, associated with the service. And that makes sense. I think because it's a kind of a real world, you know, product and service, I think for most people, you know, it makes sense that if my groceries are going to come to my door, there's got to be something, you know, some kind of, you know, fee on top of my groceries to make that happen. But, you know, there's also a cohort of users that, you know, would like, you know, that same service, but at an even lower price. And so that's kind of one common theme is, as you're doing monetization, trying to sort of find that point where you're building the right, you know, kind of business model, not only for the long-term sustainability of the business, but also an Instacart, you know, case because, you know, we're paying, you know, shoppers while sort of making sure that you're kind of fitting, you know, the consumer appetite, you know, kind of overall appetite for, you know, for dollars paid, you know, for the service. So that's one. I think on the, you know, the growth side is certainly interesting too, you know, in a case like GoFundMe. You know, one of the metrics that you look at GoFundMe is, of course, you know, how much total volume of dollars you're raising across the whole platform. That's one of the things that you're optimizing for as a business. And so to do that, you know, is a function of really two things. It's the number of campaigns that get started, as well as the yield per campaign, the dollars that you raise per campaign. And you know, there's very different approaches for how you, you know, optimize those two particular parts of the formula. You know, one is really trying to grow the number of campaigns on the platform, and the other is really tuning things like conversion, really tuning things like, you know, the social distribution of any one given campaign. And so, you know, relative to, you know, kind of an ecosystem where you don't have kind of multiple sides of the platform, you just often have dedicated teams that are working on kind of different parts of the problem. And ideally, you know, you've kind of set up the team so they can work as autonomously as possible. But of course, given it is a marketplace, there is still, you know, kind of interaction, and that often needs to be managed.
And do you remember any kind of key trade-offs? You know, obviously there's limited resources of all sorts, but do you have to identify which is the more scarce side of this two-sided marketplace? Do you make explicit feature trade-offs on something going to the shopper versus to the person buying the groceries?
Yeah, I mean, you know, trade-offs are name of the game in product. I think, you know, at GoFundMe, you know, specifically, you know, I think we went through, you know, kind of various periods of looking at, you know, something like, for example, the yield side, you know, the number of dollars you could raise on any given campaign. And, you know, you might choose to focus on a specific area like that because you look at the problem and you say, okay, wow, there's a lot of low-hanging fruit here. You know, we haven't spent a lot of time on social distribution. We haven't spent a lot of time on conversion. We haven't spent a lot of time helping our, you know, campaign organizers really describe their campaign. Cool. You know, we've got a big roadmap here. We can go execute against a bunch of these areas. Then you might fast forward a quarter and step back and say, okay, we got some wins from a couple of these categories. This other category where we thought we had, you know, sort of potentially a lot of, you know, potential wins didn't really pay off. And the other areas that did pay off, you know, they paid off, but we're not sure if there's, you know, sort of a lot of room left, you know, for improvement. And then you may decide to sort of strategically shift to kind of another area of the business. And so I think in the most mature state, you know, the kind of trade-off approach that you're making, you really do have dedicated teams on each of these areas, but your level of investment in any one of those teams will sort of change based on your strategic outlook. I think, you know, kind of earlier in the company's life cycle, you may not have, you know, multiple teams that you can kind of dedicate to each of these areas. And that's where a team might run more like I just described, where you might focus them, you know, for a while on really optimizing, you know, kind of yield per campaign. And then, you know, once you feel like you've made some good progress there and there's less low-hanging fruit, you know, move them to another side of the problem.
Yeah, that's actually a good lead into the sort of broader question about diversification of the portfolio. One of the things that tech companies, you know, need to do, of course, over time is after they've built something at core and scale and gets to what you referred to earlier as the scaling game, start to build on that, you know, reach that audience or new audiences with additional products, et cetera. So how do you think about that? How do you decide, you know, when it's time to develop a new product? How do you decide it's time to reach broader than your current audience? Like, when do you kind of know that the core is sufficiently far enough along to start to do that, but not so long that it starts to lose momentum and kind of get the company into trouble?
I think one of the most important lessons for me on this particular question was sort of in the middle of my tenure at LinkedIn, and it was maybe a year or two after Jeff Weiner had joined as CEO. You know, my role was running our three lines of business from a product perspective. So at that point, it was our enterprise business, our subscriptions business, and our advertising business. And so, again, if you think about it, you know, three pretty different, you know, businesses. And, you know, sometimes you're talking about a second price auction. Other times you're, you know, talking about, you know, sort of, you know, enterprise, you know, grade, you know, kind of infrastructure. And then you're talking about, you know, consumer churn, you know. And so, you know, I think one of the things that, you know, that Jeff did a great job at was helping us sort of step back and say, you know, at this point in the company's history, we've got, you know, three pretty different business models going. You know, is that the right move? And sort of really posing that question, and really kind of as a result of both him posing that question and, you know, in his direction, we moved from kind of focusing on all three of those business models, and we really started to double down on our talent solutions business. And so, you know, it meant that every additional resource, it meant that every additional cycle of executive time, you know, went into the talent solutions business first before we spent time on these other businesses. And honestly, it made a huge difference. You know, it really caused that business to materially accelerate, you know. And so I think, you know, from that, I've probably learned the lesson where now I sit, you know, pretty biased on the side of, you know, really making sure that that your core is strong, and that, you know, you're in a position, you know, before you're in a position to kind of move off into other areas. And I think, you know, Instacart is another great example. I mean, the product I talked about that, you know, we're sort of most proud of in terms of fulfillment quality. I mean, you know, that's what, 8 years into the company's history. And you know, what's one of the biggest investments? One of the biggest investments is still just the very basics, you know, of how you get the groceries delivered. And I think, you know, a lot of great companies, you think about Amazon, I mean, just continuing to tune, you know, the speed at which, you know, I'm going to get a given, you know, kind of product that I order on the site. And so, so I admittedly bias very much towards the core. I think the things that we had in place when we did decide to go further afield at a place like LinkedIn, you know, one, we did feel like at the time we were hearing from customers that our product set, you know, especially in Talent Solutions, was excellent. So we were getting feedback that, you know, the product was very, very strong in the form of NPS and other, you know, kind of qualitative measures. And two, when we looked at the customers, we looked at the customers that we had leveraging the tool. And, you know, it was a broad set of customers by company size. We had some very large enterprises. We had some, you know, smaller businesses. We started to have a geographic footprint that was international. And so whatever dimension you cut it by, we had made, you know, quite a bit of progress. And perhaps the most important thing is that at that point, we had really built out an excellent team. And we knew that the team, starting with kind of the leaders on the Talent Solutions business, were truly world-class. And at that point, we started to get comfortable that we could fully hand the reins to these folks. And then we could start to get distracted and spend some of our time starting to build up the teams in some of these other areas. But it was really that the last part that was most important was having confidence that, you know, if we all went away and didn't look at the business for a year, we were confident that this team, you know, was just going to do an amazing job, you know, building the product, building the business. And by the way, that doesn't mean that it's an amazing person you've hired and they've been in the seat for a couple days. It means that they're an amazing person that you've hired and they've shown you through, you know, a year or two of really hard work that, you know, they are the right person to kind of run and take the reins on this business. And so that's what we had, you know, across product, across sales, you know, we had that confidence with these extraordinary leaders. And that's what really gave us the confidence to start, you know, really doubling down in areas like our advertising business and go further afield from our core business.
It really speaks to developing leadership and culture. And, you know, earlier you also spoke about, you know, tying decisions and saying no back to vision. Are there other principles that you sort of always go back to in terms of how you lead and build organizations?
I think there's the strategic framework point. I think the other one that has always served us quite well across all these companies at LinkedIn, you know, we called it members first. You know, probably, you know, most companies out there have some version of that sort of cultural tenet of really putting the customer, you know, first. I think, you know, as with all things culture, it's easy to sort of put a lot of these things into a, you know, a culture slide deck. I think it's a very different thing to really walk the walk. And at LinkedIn, you know, partially because of, you know, some wonderful other great leaders at the company, you know, we walk the walk and, you know, across really all parts of the company, not just product, but, you know, especially an example I'm thinking of, you know, in sales where, you know, a very specific instance where there was a trade-off between kind of closing a big deal and you know, on the other side, making what we'll characterize as the member's first choice. And it was one of those teaching moments because, you know, collectively as an executive team, and especially because of the sales leader, you know, we chose the members first approach, and it was the kind of decision that was so powerful because it, you know, it really reverberated around the, you know, throughout the company that we were willing to trade off significant revenue because we were going to sort of put the customer first. And so, you know, I've tried to take that with me to other companies, and you know, at Instacart, whether it's the, you know, the customer or the shopper, really making sure that, you know, each of these products that we're building, we're sitting in their shoes, and really asking that question. And again, not being afraid to, you know, make the hard decision because of some metrics or because of, you know, the potential to miss a forecast, and really being sort of true to that principle. So I think that is probably the other one that has had sort of the most longstanding impact on my decision making.
In all these jobs, you decide to stay largely in and around product and product management roles. You must have loved that role and the role that product management plays.
I really do. You know, product has been, you know, sort of a ton of fun. I think the You know, for me, there's a couple of things that differentiate product. I think, you know, probably at the top of the list, I love the end-to-end accountability. You know, I think in a product organization, you know, the buck really stops, you know, with you. You know, it's your job to achieve, you know, the outcome. It's your job to sort of help the team achieve the outcome. There's no room for you to sort of point and say, well, this function, you know, wasn't able to deliver, or that function wasn't able to deliver. It's really on you. And I love that feeling, and I love the satisfaction that comes, you know, when you sort of execute well. It's also a very people-oriented job, and I love that aspect of it. You know, as you know well, Quentin, you know, PMs, you know, have to lead largely through influence. You know, the people that you're working with do not report to you. But I love that. I love building strong relationships with the team, earning the trust with the team, figuring out what makes them tick, and working with them to hopefully achieve, you know, great things. And I think the last piece, you know, I love the problem solving. You know, I love looking at a complex problem, trying to understand what the user needs are. And again, that satisfaction that comes from, you know, solving those problems at scale, I just find it, you know, to be immensely gratifying.
Yeah, I know it's a little tricky dealing with people as well, David. Maybe you can talk about, I know one of the hardest challenges is around communication. Maybe you can talk about some of the challenges and problems in all these different teams that you have to coordinate.
Yeah, I think, you know, on the communication side, you know, one of the things that I've always found to be most challenging, but really a core part of the job, and you guys know this well from your experience, you never have enough resources to do what you aspire to do. And it doesn't matter if you're 40 people, 1,000 people, or 10,000 people, because your aspirations just grow. And so you always have to be, you know, very strictly looking at sort of what you aspire to do versus what you have the capability, not just to do, but what you have the capability to do really, really well. And so what that means, especially for the product role, is it's your job to say no to a lot of different initiatives. And that really is the toughest part. And I think over the years, the part that's gotten easier, I think strategically, is being able to look and say, okay, this makes sense. This should be, you know, sort of greenlit. These things over here, they're interesting, but, you know, they're just not as high priority. And so we're gonna turn these off, or we're not gonna decide to invest at the moment. But the hard part is communicating, you know, those decisions. And usually what you find is a specific decision that you're deciding to, you know, it's nice to sort of have the overall product executive look. You're kind of looking at the overall portfolio. And so you can kind of make these decisions in a way that the things that you're saying no to, you know, don't necessarily sort of, you know, kind of personally, you know, hurt. But at the same time, when you're communicating those out, there may be a specific team where their whole focus was the specific thing that you're saying no to. And so I think that's, you know, that's a big part of the, you know, sort of communication challenge, I think, that, you know, to this day, you know, remains something that it was always hard to do, because you've got, you know, teams that have worked hard on things. They're passionate about, you know, certain areas. They might be passionate about an idea. It's not a lot of fun to have to go, you know, say no to those things. But you know, it's a core part of the job. And I think, you know, one of the things is really just making sure that, you know, teams are sort of aligned on a vision and aligned on strategy at the very outset. And as long as you can refer back to, you know, kind of a, you know, kind of a commonly understood, you know, strategy, I find that some of those kind of, no, we're not going to proceed with this conversations, you know, aren't quite as difficult, because, you know, people may not like it in the moment, but they understand why you made the decision. They've sort of bought into kind of the overall strategic, you know, point of view. And so I think that initial alignment is really, you know, sort of the only thing I've, you know, come up with over the years to make those conversations, you know, just a little bit easier.
We used to joke that CTO's job was always to say yes, and the PMs always had to say no. So it made it a little tricky. You've had kind of an epic career here, but if you could kind of go back in time, or more specifically, if you could give someone advice who's just getting started in the product space, what kind of advice would you give them, and what skills should they really focus on?
You know, the thing that I've seen differentiate sort of good PMs from great PMs took me a long time to sort of figure out how to describe. And even today, I would sort of describe it as, you know, great PMs just seem to have a nose for what the customer wants. And for a long time, I'd sort of leave it at that. And I just sort of assumed that there were some people that just were better at that than others. What I've sort of, you know, learned over the years is that those kind of great PMs, the PMs that, you know, seem to have a, you know, kind of a better nose for what the customer wants, it's really because they understand the customer better than anyone else. And I don't think that, you know, in some cases, I think that is because they may actually just be be the perfect customer. They may be the, you know, right in the, right smack in the middle of, you know, the demographic characteristics, you know, the you know, whatever other segmentation is relevant in a particular case. But it, more often than not, it's because they have spent the time and the energy up front, well in advance of even encountering a specific, you know, product challenge, to understand the full context of a customer. And that is, you know, it's so easy to say that, and yet it is so incredibly hard to do. But when you can really talk about a customer, when you can talk about, you know, the things that they're thinking and feeling and worried about, you know, I think the, you know, one of the best examples is, you know, somebody, you know, at Instacart was describing, you know, not just Instacart, but a lot of companies out there, of course, are, you know, whether it's food or grocery, et cetera, they have a delivery part of their business and they have a, what's, you know, what's called the pickup part of their business. And I think for a while, you know, people were a little bit like, well, gosh, why would you want to use this service to get pickup if you can have it delivered, you know? And, you know, what some really smart people on the team, you know, made clear to me at one point is they said, look, and it resonated with me as a parent. You know, they said, you know, David, think about the experience going to, you know, going to the grocery store. Now think about that experience with two young children, you know, and you know, as a parent, you know, the last thing I want to do is take my two young kids into a grocery store, you know, where every four steps down the aisle, you know, I'm gonna have to negotiate on whether or not we're buying a certain kind of cereal or a certain kind of toy or whatever else. And so, so this, you know, this really smart PM said, well, no, people that are going grocery shopping, the parents that are part of our primary demographic, you know what they get from pickup? They get to leave their kids in the car seat, you know, and it's just so spot on, you know. But if you didn't really take the time to go to the next level and really understand that, hey, that's a parent, they've got two kids in the back, they're coming back from soccer practice. Frankly, they don't necessarily want the groceries sitting on their doorstep. They don't know exactly when they're going to be home. They'd much rather just drive in front of the store and have someone kind of put it in their trunk. And so I think it's that level of understanding. I think there was another similar insight where, you know, someone was able to sort of get to the root of another reason that was kind of very pro pickup. And it was that there is some guilt. You know, there's some guilt by parents that, you know, feel like their responsibility is to do something like go to the grocery store. And again, you know, you don't come to an insight like that with a superficial level of understanding. You don't get to it just simply cutting by, well, you know, we have this percentage, you know, folks in this age cohort and this percentage, you know, with this gender breakdown, et cetera. That doesn't even come close to getting there, to getting to what you need to really truly understand it. And so I think the advice would be, you know, I remember just as, you know, my early days of product, you know, I wanted to get in there and start building something, you know, and I'd run. And actually, I think one of the examples I gave earlier about the flop was probably due to this, you know, where, you know, because I wanted to build and get started on the box and get started with engineering and everything else, I didn't value that initial understand phase, you know, and I didn't spend the time to really be able to, you know, kind of walk a day or walk a year in the years of my, in the shoes of my customer. And so, so I think for new PMs, I think if they could really hone that skill, then I think years later, they're going to be considered one of those PMs that somehow just has a nose, you know, for what customers really want. And I think they're going to find that that's pretty darn valuable.
Yeah. I mean, know your customers, so core to the PM role, right? So, David, one final question of our guests we like to bookend every show with. In your career, what have you been part of delivering that you felt was the equivalent to magic?
For me, I think that, you know, just been so fortunate to join the LinkedIn, you know, journey so early. And, you know, this is a podcast, so I can't show you what LinkedIn looked like, you know, in those early days, but you could quickly find it online. And if you think about sort of that image of just the very beginning, you know, when it just it wasn't what it is yet, and then to fast forward to a time when, you know, I can now walk into any coffee shop, you know, I can be on, you know, sort of any plane, and it's highly likely the person sitting next to me is using LinkedIn. You know, that's magic for me. You know, and again, you know, I personally played a very small part in that, and it was mostly just, you know, being able to be part of just this wonderful team, you know, and Reed and Alan having this incredible, you know, sort of idea and kind of laying out the strategy in those early days. And then all the people that, you know, worked with me to really build that into something, build it into the thing that it is today. But that's the magic is, you know, this just, you know, this really rough idea and this kind of ragtag set of people, myself included, you know, trying to figure it out. And to all of a sudden being something that, you know, really all parts of the professional world, you know, are using on a daily basis to get business done. You know, that's that feels pretty magical to me.
So, David, I've known you for a few years. You continue to impress me as one of the most thoughtful product management leaders in the Valley. I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Well, thank you both. It was wonderful to be here.
David Hahn is the former Chief Product Officer at Instacart. Equivalent to Magic is a podcast from General Catalyst, a VC firm investing in powerful, positive change. To learn more about our investment approach and portfolio, go to generalcatalyst.com.
The show is produced in partnership with Postscript Audio. Stephen Lacey and Mary Dew produced the show. Jamie Kaiser helped edit the show. Sean Marquand composed the theme song and mixed the show. And Rhonda Scott manages marketing and communications.
Please give us a rating wherever you get your shows and spread the word on social media. Stay with us as we go deep on the technical stories behind the world's most influential companies. I'm Quentin Clark.
And I'm Steve Herron. This is Equivalent to Magic.